Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to one of your local MPs, and we are speaking to Shadow Home Affairs Minister Whip and Labour MP Bambos Charalambos to get the answers to your questions. Remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get an answer from Bambos this time, he will be back again next month fielding your questions. But since we last talked, Bambos, it was a little while ago. It feels like a long while ago at the moment with everything that's going on. There was the furore around Christmas being on or off. So I do have to ask, were you still able to enjoy the festive period?
Well, it was a very different Christmas from the ones you have, because usually it's with the full family. But so it was a very, very quiet Christmas, and I think it's for everybody. But I think now when you see the infection rates so high, I think it was the right thing to do. Although I wish we would have more notice of that beforehand, so they could actually, some people really had plans to travel and to meet people. But yeah, I think, you know, I think for most people, they were willing to forego the Christmas gone and New Year just gone, if that would help get us closer to a solution where we don't have to put up with the restrictions that we're enduring under COVID.
And just talking about these restrictions, because also since we last had our discussions, the country has entered a total lockdown. I do have to ask, how much has this affected your work and your ability to serve your constituents and also as your job as a whip within Parliament?
Well, all my staff have been working from home, so we've tried to adjust how the office operates to provide as best service as we can. So means that I'm the only person allowed to go into the office constituency. So I check a post and I scan the post. We encourage people who can email us, and so we do a lot more work via email. Parliament is also greatly reduced as well. So we're trying to put as many people away from Parliament as possible. So the rules have been adjusted so people can participate virtually in debates now, which changed that was only introduced after the most recent lockdown. So there's very few people in Parliament, but some of the people that have to be in Parliament are the whips. So, and what we've done is we divide the time that whips come in, so we do know, so it's 1 week on, week off, but when you are here, you do double shifts basically, and so yeah, it's been weird being here when there's anyone around, but if that's what it takes to get through it, then that's what it takes.
And just on that decision making there of on and off within Parliament, is that something that's come from Parliament itself, or is this a Labour Party only kind of objective to control coronavirus within our politics?
I think all the opposition parties and many people on the government side have been very keen for us to put in measures where Parliament can't operate remotely for quite a while now, and I think the resistance has been from a very few people in cabinet, but I think this, seeing this strain and the impact it was having, I think eventually the big issue was people participating in debates remotely. Tracy Crouch, who's a Conservative MP, she raised the issue about this in Business Questions a few months ago. She has breast cancer, and she wanted to take part in a debate about breast cancer, and she was prevented from doing that because the rules weren't in place to allow her to take part remotely. It's also safe for her to attend Parliament. It wasn't the time for her to do that. To take part physically, and that's why the rules have changed. So I'm pleased the rules have changed now, and I'm pleased that people like Tracy and other MPs that might have underlying conditions who can't weren't able to participate previously aren't able to participate, as those of us that are able to get here physically. And it was long overdue, so pleased that these rules are now in place. But I wish it happened much, much sooner than it has done.
And we have entered a new year here, 2021. It's January, coming towards the end of the month, but you've already been super busy, Bambos, with quite a few things that you've been involved in. And one that I wanted to highlight is actually this week, you wrote to Gavin Williamson on what you feel are issues with the handling of education during the COVID-19 crisis. You pointed out that gathering clear data on staff sicknesses and absence, giving schools the funding they need, and a post-COVID plan for schools were amongst many of the problems that need to be sorted. Do you feel positive that the government will listen to your calls and implement changes, or have you had no feedback whatsoever?
I've had no feedback yet to my letter, but I wasn't expecting one this week. But I do hope governments take a long, hard think about the way they've been dealing with the lockdown, particularly in relation to education things. Just the fact that so many schools are, you know, have been left in a quandary as to whether they're going to be opening or closing. What the guidance was, meeting some head teachers last week, one of the teachers said I think the guidance had changed 35 or 36 times, and you had to like literally go through it and compare it to what was there before to find where the changes were, because it wasn't always obvious. But just giving the teachers advance notes, I was on a call on New Year's Eve with the schools minister, myself and other London MPs, and they were saying that certain boroughs, schools were going to close. Bear in mind they were going to be open, they were due to open on the Monday, but other boroughs were not. So they were saying Enfield school is going to close because they've got high infection rate, but it's not as high as Haringey, so Haringey school will be open, which seemed totally daft because children from Enfield, some go to schools in Haringey and vice versa. So if it was meant to control the infection, that was, you know, stupid idea. In 24 hours, they'd changed it. So all schools in London were going to close because the virus was spreading. So just the uncertainty, and, you know, the people forget the schools have been open throughout the pandemic, for particularly to look after children of key workers or critical workers. And that's still the case now. So even though people think schools are closed, schools are actually open, and they are teaching the children of critical workers. And that causes other problems in relation to remote learning, how that's being funded, the issue about free school meals, how many laptops schools are provided to allow, to enable remote learning. All these things have been really poorly handled. And I do think we need to give credit to teachers, all staff in schools, for the incredible work they've done. And people forget many of them have also contracted COVID, and yet the schools still seem to provide service. And my heart goes to them, and I do think they've been providing an excellent service. And I hope the government get their act together and give them advance notice of things change.
Would you double down on your criticism, though, Bambos? Because actually this week, Ed Davey, another opposition party leader, said that Gavin Williamson is the worst education secretary in living memory. Do you believe that that sentiment is correct? Would you agree with that? And I asked Daisy Cooper this, but what would Labour do differently than what Gavin Williamson has done himself?
Well, I think I know that my colleagues have also called for Gavin Williamson to resign, and I do think he's not been the best education secretary. I don't know if he's the worst, but he's the amount of issues that have done U-turn in education has been just ludicrous. You know, just the shocking change in has just shown that there's a serious lack of leadership. And I thought he'd have gone with the exam fiasco, but clearly that wasn't good enough. I mean, I think what What we would is certainly we want to keep schools open. There need to be safe places to study. But, you know, we also need to give schools and teachers and school governors time to prepare for that. So I think as much advance warning of anything that's coming down the line, better organising the whole issue around laptops. And it's not about laptops, it's about data. In advance, giving advance notes about exams. I mean, at the moment, we're still uncertain about whether kids will have to take any exams or not. They said they weren't going to take exams, and they said they were going to have like watered down exams. So there's still this uncertainty, and it's uncertainty that's, you know, really affecting people. So it's giving greater guidance, greater, it's leadership, basically. You've got to give leadership, you've got to be clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it. You've got to make sure that you give that notice in advance, and that you show that you have a plan, and that you, and you give greater understanding as to what you're doing and why you're doing it, and explain it, and make it happen.
Now, one of the topics that you're also passionate about, but the government has given a fair bit of warning on this, is actually the 2021 rail fare rises. This is especially poignant for commuters when they return to offices post-COVID, and this is all due to a rise in fares that would see about 42% raise more than in 2010. So in 11 years, it's gone up by a fair bit. What can you do to stop this ban, boss, because you're raising the profile of this? And again, if Labour in power, how would things be done differently to assure that commuters weren't getting this huge rise in fares?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that people don't realise is the government actually agreed the fare rise for the rail companies in advance. Even though rail companies are implementing it, it's been agreed with the government beforehand. I mean, there's been a huge underinvestment in the rail infrastructure for many years, and commuters have had to pay for that through fare increases. I think the key thing is we need to understand that people, if we want to get people off the roads, if we want to get people using public transport, it has to be affordable. And we've got to make sure that it is within reach of most people who have no choice but to commute. But one thing I will say is that what the pandemic has taught us is how we can work remotely. So if the fares are increased to such an extent that people say, well, actually, if I can work from home, I can save myself a huge amount of money by not buying tickets, then that might be something that makes government and rail companies think again about increasing fares. But the rail companies that are would have taken a hit, they'd have been bailed out by the government, and they'll recoup their money, which might be why looking at increases now. So we'll wait and see. But I do think you need to think about why you provide service in the first place and start from that perspective.
Would the discussions of rail renationalisation come into the Labour sphere of discussion? I mean, do you think that the Conservatives should be considering that?
Well, they already did it with the Eastern Main Line. So when I think it was Stagecoach, or I may be wrong with the company, but I think it was Stagecoach, when they collapsed in providing that service, then the government stepped in and ran it, and people were very complimentary about how well it was being run. I mean, you know, having a rail franchise is a license from print money, basically, because you have no competition. You are providing the train service for that line wherever it is. So I do think that needs to be looked at again. And obviously the government owned the track, but whether it's the other stuff is provided the rail company, you know, it was our manifesto, and I think that if it was nationalised, it certainly would be improvement. But I also think that sometimes you don't necessarily need to change things for the sake of changing things. So we'll see where we are in this time. A lot of these companies have got long contracts, so maybe after a contract expired, maybe then, you know, sort of whether we need to nationalise it or not would be a good thing.
You've expressed there that obviously nationalisation is within the sphere of thinking of the labour movement, but is there alternatives as well? You know, you talk about lack of competition, and it does seem like a natural monopoly, but you would talk to economists like Johan Norberg, who would say there's no such thing as that. Do you think that maybe more competition should be brought in? Is that an alternative system that you believe in, or is it just not possible with the train networks in this country?
Well, I do think that you have to, you know, if you look at it from the point of view that a private company is there to make profit, and the profit will either be from the fares from passengers or by cutting certain conditions of staff, because those are going to be the two, you know, biggest areas where they're going to be able to either raise revenue or reduce it. So if you're from that premise that someone's to make money out of it, and I see travel as a service, you shouldn't necessarily make money, or any money you do make should fed back into it, then I think it's probably a healthier starting point. So you know, and I've never been able to understand why people see that public sector and body can't be run efficiently. I think they can, and they'd be. And I think that's actually where we start from.
So let's move on to a victory that you've had this week in many senses. Are you proud that Labour held an opposition day debate and won by a landslide of 278-0 on the issuing of cancelling the cut to universal credit, or the fact that the Conservatives abstained at so many numbers? As you can see there, only 278 votes were really cast. Does that devalue it a little bit?
No, I think there were six rebels in that 278. So I think that was actually quite a strong victory. And it showed the general unease, because I think many of the Red Wall Tories, they would have many people who would on universal credit in their constituencies who would benefit by having the increase. And let's be honest, I mean, under COVID, people have really suffered, and COVID's going to impact on people's lives, certainly for the months ahead. So this increase of £20 per week would greatly help many, many people out there. It could be the difference between, you know, survival or not, you know, in some cases. So I think it's it's a very beneficial thing to do. It's the right to do. And I think that's why the Tories didn't want to oppose it, because they knew it was the right thing to do. But we forced the vote and we won. So, and the rumours that I've heard is that it's something government are considering altering. They've had the bad publicity as a result of it. They're getting lots of rebellion from backbenchers as well. So it shows it was the right thing to do. It's the right subject to choose. It shows the government vulnerable on this. And I think it's our duty in opposition to make the government change their mind on things that we believe are the right things to do. And this is one of them.
Continuing this trend of talking about cancelling the cut, but this is all linked to the big A word that scares a lot of people around Britain, austerity. And there's discussions now in the ether about national debt getting out of control again. And an example I'm giving to you, which I have done to Daisy Cooper and will do to Bim Afolabi of the Conservatives, is the fact that post-World War II, we all know that Clement Attlee was leader of the Labour-run government, but they had a Keynesian style of economics where the budget was run in such a sense that the growth of Britain was put first. Now, why is balancing the books taking precedent over the long-term growth of the country, especially at a time of crisis? And what I will add as well is this is something that has been echoed by Joe Biden during his inauguration speech. He said we shouldn't focus on the deficit, and he's backed up by people such as the IMF. So, yeah, why is this focus on balancing the books taking precedent, Bambos?
A very good question. I mean, I think right now people need a helping hand, and I think that's what governments should be there for. Mentioned the 1945 Attlee government, and you know, it's no surprise that they needed support, got help from the Americans through the Marshall Plan, and that took many, many years to be paid off. I think when we paid it off now, 20 or 30 years, so it, you know, it's so again, that was there was a loan there, was paid off, but I think you have to be there to help people at a time of need. That's what the government should be there to provide that support. But I also think I think also you're there to do good as well. And I think just growth is one particular measure people use, but growth is a relatively new thing. It's only been around since the 1930s, 1940s. Before that, you know, people were measuring things by growth. But I do think you need to think about other things that you're doing that benefit the community and society, because you sometimes growth also has an adverse impact on things like the environment and other things, and you do need to be clear what your priorities are. So the priorities should be at this stage help people who are struggling, trying to get people into work, people back into jobs, make sure that people that need help support are supported into that, and supporting community groups. There'll be lots of community groups that are suffering, businesses that are suffering, and particularly the smaller local ones, and I think trying to help those out, and also helping those agencies, those organizations that keep us together. So, you know, the small voluntary groups that provide an outlet for some of us, forgetting our public body as well. Loads of councils have helped out, and they've taken a big hit recently. They've lost loads of revenue that they, you know, would have earmarked. They've had cuts year on year. So I think focusing on areas do good would be a good starting point. And I actually think if you focus on those areas, you will actually end up seeing growth anyway. But focusing on growth, you won't necessarily see improvement in those areas.
So let's move it from macroeconomics to a more micro level and discuss about things that are affecting the local community. And as always, with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community. And we called for questions for you, Bambos. So let's move it into what the people of the local area want to know. And Michelle has sent in a question, and she explains, "I'm worried as the government's new protocol of giving vaccines 12 weeks from the first injection instead of 3 weeks is not yet backed by science. There's an insistence on vaccinating people as quickly as possible, but what's the point if it's not done safely?"
We need to look at the stuff behind that, but my understanding is that the first jab gives you something like a 90% sort of protection, and the second jab boosts that as well. I think the government has been very keen trying to give as many people that first jab as possible. So it's being rolled out. I'm pleased we're getting so many people vaccinated. I think the distribution has been a bit patchy in different parts of the country. I want to look at the science behind that. So I'm happy to get back to Michelle about the specifics of science, but it has been a decision taken by government to try and vaccinate people the first vaccine as quickly as possible. And I think once their bodies, people's bodies get used to that vaccine, the second one is also is a booster. But you do get some protection for the first one. So I think that's why I'm keen to give that protection as quickly as possible.
So moving on to another question, and this one is a directly local one. We got sent in this one actually just before going in on air. And Caroline has sent in a message saying, "Do you believe that the COVID cycle lanes should be scrapped because a judge has just ruled that they are unlawful?"
I think the ruling she's referring to is specific to the Mayor for London ones, but the ones that the Bishopsgate and other ones in specific particular areas. I mean, obviously, if things have been ruled unlawful, then they're unlawful. So I think that's. But I do think that we do need to look at reduction of car use where possible. I think we need to look at alternatives of transport where possible. Anything that helps reduce that and helps increase the air that we breathe is a good thing. With LTNs in particular, I think it will depend on which LTNs have been ruled unlawful. If they're unlawful, they're unlawful, and action should be taken to rectify that.
So moving on, and Ryan has actually sent a question about your previous party leader. He said, "Do you feel that Jeremy Corbyn would have fared better at this moment in time? Mr. Corbyn seems to have been vindicated with the pointing out that internet is now a basic human need with the problems that we have all experienced during lockdown." What are your thoughts and feelings on that one, Bambos?
Well, I think that our manifesto that we stood on in 2019 was a good manifesto, and it would be great to see some of those policies implemented. Unfortunately, we didn't choose those policies, and you know, now where we are, unfortunately, one of those policies was about the provision of universal broadband, and there were so many good policies that people didn't choose not to support us, whatever the reasons were for that, whether thoughts Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't have made, you know, whether they preferred Boris Johnson to Jeremy Corbyn, whether that was a reason, whether it was other reasons, whether it was Brexit, whether it was other reasons, I don't know. But for whatever reason, they chose the Conservatives to the majority and be the government today. And you know, it's fine to speculate, but we lost under Jeremy, and we are where we are. If we'd won with him, it'd have been a great policy we could have implemented, but unfortunately, that's not where we are.
And just on the topic of Jeremy Corbyn, and I respect that last time you were not able to divulge anything because you said it's an ongoing investigation, but have things moved further forward with his position within the Labour Party? Can you divulge anything that has gone on with this current investigation?
Well, I personally don't know apart from what I've read in the newspapers, so I have no nothing to add to that. So I'm sorry, I can't help there.
That is fair enough, Bambos. So we will move it on to Sophia and Steve's question. We actually had quite a few questions about these low traffic neighborhoods, and I tried to select the best questions. So Sophia's question was, "Please, can you ask Bambos how he feels about the displaced traffic surrounding the Fox Lane low traffic neighborhood?"
Well, I think the intention of the low traffic neighbourhoods is for traffic to be dissipate. And if all it's done is just display traffic and made it heavier on other roads, then I'd have serious concerns about how effective that low traffic neighbourhood had been. At the moment, there's a consultation. It usually takes a while for a scheme to have been implemented to see the final. What the final results have been in relation to dissipation of traffic. So the Enfield Council implementing the scheme are going to produce their finding following the end of the consultation period. So I'd be very interested to see whether, in fact, the traffic has dissipated. If all that's happened is traffic has been pushed onto other roads and other people get the problem, then that'd be a serious concern. And I wouldn't have regarded that as a success.
Steve has added to this, as I said here, there's quite a few questions about this, but he's asked why, when surveys have shown overwhelming opposition to them, is are you not opposing or intervening the halt of the rollout across Enfield, Southgate and North London for these low traffic neighbourhoods that are creating gridlock and causing pollution and misery for residents across the borough. These schemes are unfairly penalising those of us reliant upon our cars to go out, with the realistic hope of encouraging those who aren't to seek alternatives. What do you say to that specific question there from Steve Bambos?
There are two sides to every argument, and some people actually like and prefer the quieter roads, and some people have had to endure years and years of traffic down their roads with any solution. So I think we need to like strike a balance there. But obviously there's a consultation going on at the moment. So I think we need to see what the outcome of that consultation is. As an MP, you have to balance people's views. But you're never going to sort of satisfy everybody. There is such opposition to the to a scheme like so you have to all I say is there are also many people that support the scheme well, who are not as vocal as some people who participate in social media and campaigns. Some people actually like the quiet streets. Let's say it's a value judgment, but I do think that we need to see whether the low traffic neighbourhood has worked or not. As I say, the consultation is ongoing, and we need to see the results of the consultation. And it's the council scheme. It's been funded by government money. So the government wants it. They think it's a good idea. The council are implementing it. So we're going to see what the results are. But clearly, I don't want to back something that isn't going to benefit the community. So let's see where it gets us.
So for fairness, we can summarise here, Bambos, that you will come out in, proposing it or opposing it with empirical evidence from data and also from that consultation period. Is that what you're saying, Bambos?
Well, I think we need to see. It clearly has to be based on evidence, because you have to see what the effect has been. Has been any impact, or has it not worked at all? And we need to sort of see what's happened. As I said, if all that's happened is that it's just caused a problem for other people, then that wouldn't be a good solution in my view. But we do need to see what the figures tell us, what the vaccine figures tell us. I'm a believer in evidence-based solutions. If something doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you need to back up. You need to back it up with the science. You need to back it up with the stats and the facts and figures and measurements to support your case on. Yeah, there's lots of anger about particular sort of your other particular points. But what I would say is let's wait and see what the evidence tells.
Moving it to Helen's question, and I think this was quite an interesting one about striking fairness and balance whilst being in a political position. And she asked, prior to becoming a parliamentary MP, you were a local councillor for some years representing the same community you now serve as an MP. Regardless of personal views, how do you think you should represent extremely diverse needs and interests of that community without being seen to show empathy for one section of that community?
It's a good question. I mean, you have to, as an MP, you would have situations where some people want something, other people don't want that thing, and you have to use your judgment. And that's partly why MPs are, that's one of the things that MPs have to do. It's not always going to be easy for some people to accept, but if you justify your reasons for doing that, if you explain to people why you've done something, even though you must agree with them, then hopefully that will give an understanding and an insight into why you've chosen a particular viewpoint. But as I said earlier, you're never going to satisfy everybody as an MP. You have to use the best information at your disposal. You have to listen to all the arguments, but ultimately you have to take a judgment. And as an MP, you can't always make everybody happy. Although I do try my best.
I'm sure a lot of people appreciate that, Bambos. Moving it to an issue that you have expressed a large opinion and that you do indeed feel will be of the detriment to the area. Ian has pointed out that you have opposed the Palace Gardens building proposal. He's asked, what kind of development would you back to improve the area and add much needed housing and commerce?
Yeah, well, I think everyone would agree that Palace Gardens does need to have a revamp. But building a 26-story skyscraper in the middle of Enfield Town it doesn't fit well with what's actually quite a nice market town centre, which is like seen as the heart of Enfield. So I think any development has to be a sustainable one. It has to be one that is in keeping with the character of the area. I think you can have both. You can have a revamp. You can have something that's sympathetic to the area, and you can provide the housing. So all I'm saying is that the scheme that I've seen, it's not been submitted a planning application yet, but the scheme that I've seen, not one that I can sort in the current presentation, although there are things I like about it. I do like the emphasis on the Enfield's revamping of Palace Gardens, but not the not the tower block. That's just too much. 26 stories is very high, and be seen from miles around.
So would you say that the 26-foot story tower is the main sticking point, and the other things like the cinema and the addition of shops or those other elements that concern you maybe about bringing more people into Enfield without actually adding schools and medical provisions?
I think, you know, I mentioned earlier about sustainability, but that also includes sustainability of services, because obviously there'll be pressures on schools and medical services. So it's got to be a balance. So you've got to see about what the impact's going to be on the local area. But certainly attracting more people to Enfield Town as a shopping destination is a good thing. I think we've seen too many empty shop fronts for too long. And I think people aren't coming to Enfield Town shopping centre as much as they were before, because it does need a bit of regeneration and a revamp. And I think this be, the time is right for that. But anything that happens has to be done sustainably, has to be keeping the character of the area. And it has to be something that does add to the area, doesn't make it worse.
The final question that we've got this week, Bambos, and it's from Rhiann. We actually got quite a few questions on this topic as well, mainly because it's such a big issue that a lot of people care about. But I thought this one was the best one to kind of allow you to explain why you've, you know, taken the position that you have done. And Rhiann has asked, why did you vote to back the Brexit bill?
Okay, well, start off with the when we voted, when the EU withdrawal bill was passed, it set in law the transition date would end on the 31st of December. And so on the 30th of December, we had to either vote for the Brexit bill, and if it didn't pass, we would have a no deal. And the no deal would have been catastrophic for the community. Now, this bill is not one that I think is a great bill. It's not one that I think couldn't be improved on. But it was either choice or no deal. And throughout my time in an MP, I've always said I would not do anything that would risk having a no deal. And so that reason, the only sensible option was to support the deal that had been done. There was no chance to renegotiate it. So people who voted against it were actually saying prefer a no deal because there was no time to negotiate something else. And also what had happened was this deal had been agreed with many countries, the 27 countries as well. So it was just we can come back with something else that we, you know, a week later. This was like if you're looking at the midnight clock, it was 11:59:59. There was no other, we were being timed out, and that's the only reason I voted for it.
So I do try to end each of these interviews with a positive. So first of all, I will say to you, do you feel that if Labour were in power, they could get a better deal?
I'm sure of it. Some of the things that were negotiated away weren't anywhere near as, things like Erasmus. I mean, why that was negotiated away? Why allowing students from other countries to come study in the UK, and vice versa, to get that experience and knowledge and insight into other cultures is just stupidity in my point of view. So yeah, there are many things that we could have negotiated that would have been far better. It's wishful thinking because of the outcome of the election result in 2019. But also we have to behave responsibly, and a no deal would have been, would have been ruinous. And I think that was why I voted I did.
And again, on the final point here, trying to find some positivity, maybe a silver lining to the situation, can you offer assurance for local residents around the Brexit deal? Is there a lot to worry about it? Because again, we did get sent in a lot of questions about this, because there is a real genuine anxiety from some members in the community around this deal.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see how it pans out. I mean, I think there's a real concern about fish and about sort of the food and about standards. Let's make no bones about it. I think the Tories, one of the reasons they wanted to get Brexit done was that they would actually have a race to the bottom to because they want to get rid of certain standards. We've heard about their desire to get rid of some workers' rights in recent weeks. We've heard problems that people are experiencing, particularly I mentioned the fishermen and about sort of the bureaucracy its borders. So I do think there are problems that will come forward we haven't foreseen yet, but we'll have to wait and see what they are. We need to be there to criticise the government when those problems arise, and hold them to account as to why these problems have arisen. So we need to make sure that we're on top of it, we're on top of the detail, we're on top of the problems that arise, and we hold them to account as any opposition should do.
Well, on that note there, Bambos, I hope that does give a bit of assurance to some of the listeners, because, like I said, a lot of people have been worried about that. But I do have to thank you for your time, Bambos. For the first time in 2021, we'll be chatting to you throughout the year. And just a reminder for those who didn't have their question answered, Bambos will be returning next month. But for now, Bambos, I wish you well, and thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you.